The next topic discussed by the think tank faculty was surgery for hepatic-only liver metastases, and 10 of the faculty believe this strategy is being underutilized in community practice. A key question is whether preoperative systemic therapy should be given before surgery, and the faculty was evenly split about this, taking into careful consideration an ASCO presentation of an EORTC trial demonstrating benefit to perioperative systemic therapy in patients undergoing surgery for hepatic metastases. A related issue is timing of systemic therapy and surgery, particularly related to bevacizumab, as commented on by Dr. Lee Ellis.
Axel, myself, and Steve Curley wrote an editorial some time ago on this, and this was not based on data. This was based on, I know it sounds funny coming from a surgeon, but PK issues, etc. And because the half-life of bevacizumab is 20 days, and we know that at very low levels of bevacizumab in the circulation, you can neutralize all circulating VEGF, we had suggested that you wait approximately 6 to 8 weeks after the last dose of Bev in order to do a safe liver resection. Now, there have been a number of studies, some from MD Anderson, some that was just presented by Dan, which suggests that patients can probably safely undergo liver resection even after the last dose of Bev is only within the last 5 or 6 weeks. One of the things which we have to face pragmatically is, why rush? In other words, if a patient is responding to therapy with, let's say, FOLFOX plus Bev, why push it? Why continue to give bevacizumab? Why not either give them a break or give them FOLFOX by itself and allow the bevacizumab to get out of the circulation? And there's also issues in regards to wound healing, although it hasn't come up in this study. The Scappaticci paper in 2005 suggested that patients who were receiving bevacizumab and had to undergo surgery had a higher incidence of wound healing complications and hemorrhage during their surgery. So pragmatically, at the present time, what we do is we do wait 6 to 8 weeks. We will talk to our medical oncologist and say perhaps we can give one or two courses of FOLFOX or chemotherapy in between, give the patients a little break to get back on their feet before they undergo surgery, and then they feel a little bit better by the time they come into surgery with the bevacizumab out of their system.
And Norm, understanding that hepatic resection is not the same as breast cancer surgery, one of the most exciting trials in breast cancer right now is the NSABP B40 trial using chemo plus or minus Bev neoadjuvantly. How did you all think through the strategy of Bev prior to surgery there?
You know, I think one can't be flippant about the potential complications, but on the other hand, as with every novel agent that we bring into the preoperative setting, we tend to overemphasize the potential negatives. So we factored in, you know, a washout period for Bev prior to the operation.
But you have to keep the chemo going, as Lee was just talking about.
It also should be noted that we also went through the same hand-wringing when we used preoperative anthracyclines. And we were told that we could not do it because wounds would fall apart. There was a host of studies showing that in animals, tensile strength of incisions after doxorubicin treatment was attenuated, and that never proved to be a factor.
Herb, what is your current thought? And I want to, of course, get Lee's thought on this, too, in terms of the mechanism of action of Bev. And also the question of, what about the issue of VEGF receptors on the tumor cell? We saw some stuff in breast cancer has come out about that.
So my thinking on this is largely that these mechanisms are a black box, which are interesting and hypothesis generating, but the top message is survival and progression benefit from large controlled studies. With that caveat, there are a couple explanations which are intriguing and plausible. One is that there's synergy between the tumor compartment and the host stromal compartment, of which the endothelial cells and VEGF play a big role. And if you inhibit the stroma, the tumor is affected. If you affect the tumor, the stroma is affected, and those are synergistic compartments to target. There's also a theory related to drug delivery, which gets very complicated very quickly, which has to do is if you prune off the more dysfunctional vessels, which are thought to be these immature VEGF-dependent vessels, the remaining pruned back vasculature may actually be better at delivering blood and the things in blood, like oxygen and drugs. And that may in turn make bevacizumab a physiologic or functional chemosensitizer. That is, it may improve drug delivery. It may also affect the microenvironment, which in turn may make tumor cells more sensitive to that chemotherapy in the first place.
Lee, can you comment on all that and also the issue of what would you expect theoretically about radiation therapy in Bev?
Well, I agree with Herb that there are multiple mechanisms of action, and it's a black box right now. I think that Bev is anti-angiogenic in the strictest sense that you block new blood vessel growth, but clearly you don't block it forever. And because of the redundancy of other factors, you do get progression of tumors even in the face of bevacizumab. I think the one consistent finding through all the clinical trials with biomarkers is the fact that when you look at blood flow to a tumor, especially permeability, but particularly blood flow with CT scan, immediately after bevacizumab or anti-VEGF therapy, you get this decrease in blood flow, which is a vasoconstriction. Now, whether you call that normalization, which Herb just described briefly, or whether it's vasoconstriction, where you're actually limiting blood flow, we're not clear about. But the fact that you have a decrease in blood flow occurs so quickly after administration of the drug suggests that it's not vessel dropout, but it has to be some vasoconstrictive effect. In regards to radiation therapy, and of course Joel's in a better position to comment on this, but the endothelial cells may be sensitized to radiation therapy by blocking the VEGF survival signal within endothelial cells, because tumor endothelial cells are more sensitive than normal endothelial cells, which have pericyte coverage and other survival factors. So why it may work with the addition of radiation therapy, I think, is unclear right now. And even if it does work better than chemoradiation therapy, i.e. the addition of anti-VEGF therapy to chemoradiation therapy, I think is still a subject of debate and hasn't been shown in any phase 3 trial as of this date.
And Joel, we have the issue of Bev, and it was part of neoadjuvant therapy, chemoradiation therapy with rectal cancer. It's being looked at from the non-radiation oncologist perspective. We think about oxygenation. You hear conflicting things, you know, anti-angiogenic, better blood vessels. How do you think Bev is going to play out with radiation therapy?
Well, as you suggest, a lot of people assumed when they started out that Bev would be bad for radiation. And then they came to be a number of animal studies demonstrating that there was some beneficial effect. And there have been a small amount of preliminary data in humans suggesting that it might be beneficial. But I think we've got a long ways to go to sort that out.
Bob, you have the pilot study at your place, I think, that actually closed, that was looking at capecitabine radiation therapy in Bev. Any clues there?
I just talked to Chris Crane about this. We actually have one more slot on the trial before it closes. Right now, the PATH CR rate is looking like it's around 22%, which is respectable, although I don't think it's a heck of a lot higher than what you might receive with an infusional 5-FU or capecitabine approach. It's always hard because the numbers are always small, and if, in fact, we had more bulky tumors on that trial, a PATH CR 22% would be pretty good. So I certainly think that it is an interesting molecule to continue to study as a radiosensitizer. I've been fine with tolerance. I think there are some issues getting back to the surgical issues of using Bev prior to a surgical intervention that we're still working on. I definitely think it's worthy of further investigation, not just in rectal cancer, but in other disease sites. We're looking at it in pancreas cancer, et cetera.
And I guess Chris Willett have talked about maybe you have a lot of patients who aren't PATH CRs, but are clinical CRs, and you see microscopic disease.
Correct. People are starting to wonder, is PATH CR as firm an endpoint as we need to have, or are residual microscopic foci pretty much close enough? And this is where we haven't analyzed the data fully.
Herb?
I really would like to emphasize for the audience that the data to date is so small from such pilot studies in highly selected patients that there really cannot be any statement around efficacy or even toxicity, and that such treatment really should be restricted to clinical research.
Now you're talking about Bev as neoadjuvant for
Correct.
Rectal? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And in particular, I think there's an issue related to potential toxicity that needs to be respected. Much like we've seen first-line colon cancer, the PACE data, there's a very easy way where if toxicity is increased, patients may not be able to receive all of their radiation therapy, and inability to receive radiation as planned is a very big variable as far as treatment outcome.
Norm?
Yeah, there are more data, although phase 2 in breast, than there are with the rectum. And certainly there's an increasing popularity for the use of bevacizumab in inflammatory breast cancer together with radiation, with some pretty remarkable results. I mean, granted uncontrolled, but remarkable results.
Although one thing, Lee, that was seen there, that was Sandy Swain's work out of the NCI, was they did have some wound problems in that study in the inflammatory breast cancer.
And in the trial that Bob just discussed, I reviewed Chris Crane's slides yesterday. There were 22 patients on the trial. They went to surgery. Two of those patients had major dehiscences post-op. And as Herb
mentioned, doesn't that sound like par?
Well, not for our institute. I'm sorry, Norm.
Really?
But but as Herb mentioned, this is too early. But
absolutely,
these are warning signs of things that we need to look for in future trials. But this should not be used in community practice at the present time.
Now, this pilot study you guys have been doing, what was the interval from the end of Bev to surgery?
It was the usual 5 to 6 weeks.
So you saw two dehiscences. Dan?
A question about potential late toxicity. These data are frequently lost in clinical trials as to the functionality of a patient 4, 5, 6 years out. We obviously don't have it on bevacizumab, but for Lee and Joel and Norman, how high is your concern that radiation is, in a sense, anti-angiogenic? Because most of the toxicities are vascular when it comes to it, whether patients are continent, bleeding, et cetera, et cetera. What about a negative synergy at a later date? In other words, having gotten, in some studies, a year of bevacizumab and have gotten full-course radiotherapy, may not have much toxicity during the treatment, but 4 or 5 years later, having much worse late toxicities.
What, getting the anastomosal Cicatrix or
stenosis? Incontinence. I mean, we know from the Mayo data from Carl Morgan that, you know, just radiation alone, 4 and 5 years later, when they finally asked people questions, although people said, gee, my bowels are pretty okay meant 4 to 6 bowel movements per day and 50% with nocturnal diarrhea. Nobody really collects those data.
I'm going to ask Bob to respond to a couple of the poll questions we asked the faculty that are kind of interesting answers. The first is, what's your general impression on the use of, in clinical practice, evaluating and sending patients for potentially curative resection of liver mets? You know, something that you all have been talking a lot about in the last 2 or 3 years. And the sentiment here, clearly, for most people, is the thinking that maybe this needs to be done more in the community. Bob, do you agree or disagree with that?
When I was asked to answer this question, I tried to put in a couple of qualifiers because I think it is hard to have a complete sense of what's going on out there. My view when I see patients from the outside is that these things are not being done with discipline. There is not a plan of action. When liver mets show up, sometimes they go immediately to a surgeon. Sometimes they go for a therapy. There doesn't seem to be any algorithm out there in terms of how this is approached. And the other problem that I see is that when a hepatic surgeon is not available, the thinking is an RF ablation is equivalent. And so when good hepatic surgery is not available to oncologists, they'll sort of say, well, didn't have a hepatic surgeon, went for RF, gave him chemotherapy on the back end. And this is, I think it's unfortunate. And, you know, I've seen patients who've gone to a hepatic surgeon, had a hepatic resection with metastatic disease clearly on the CT left behind. And so just because you say, I know how to do liver surgery, doesn't necessarily mean you're doing it right. So from my view, I think it needs to be done more, but it needs to be done more with discipline. These ideas of perioperative therapy, neoadjuvant therapy, what is going to be the plan pre-op, what's the plan post-op, what's the role of RF? All these things, I think, need to be laid out really with a group mentality than a surgeon deciding to do something, a medical oncologist deciding to do something. There's not enough discipline in this whole area. I think we have a lot to learn, but I just see it being done in what I call a willy-nilly fashion. That's my sense.
Well, there's a lot of complexities to making these decisions. Our group, as an education group, we were interested in one effort that actually tried to look at that. And Dan, you were part of this, which was the OncoSurge initiative. Can you talk a little bit about that and what it tried to do? What were the positives and negatives? And is there a need for something, you know, that'll provide some kind of structure about how to make these decisions?
Right. The OncoSurge project was a project that used expert testimony, if you will. The first part of the project was to do a very large review of prognostic factors that we should look at and to educate everybody in the room. So there were 4 or 5 liver surgeons from the U.S. and from abroad, including Dr. Noor Leger and myself and many other people. We had then to sit down and make up case scenarios. and people brought in various models, and we used the models of people with one liver met 8 years out from surgery, all the way up to people who had eight liver metastases, a hepatic node, just a wide array. And then we voted on those as to what we would do. Now, one thing you have to remember, we also had two radiologists in the room to help us understand it, is we had radiologists and liver surgeons voting on chemotherapy answers and chemotherapy people answering liver questions, resection questions as to what they would or would not. I still don't know where segment 8 is. It's in there somewhere. So, but
it's near segment 7.
Is it? I assumed so. I actually asked where segment 9 was, and I said, there isn't one. I have one. And that was the test set. And then they came back about 6 months later, and we did a validation set. And what we did was say what we would do in certain situations, and you can get on OncoSearch on the web. And basically, it's a level 3 sort of expert consensus. You know, if they had a different group of 15, you might have gotten very different answers. But in general, it's fairly tight. But again, that could just be bias and Delphian thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it looked fancy. You had the RAND technology and all, yes. But it looked a lot like what we're doing, which is asking experts
right.
what they do.
Right.
There's a lot more cases and a lot more complexity. But it seemed like it maybe never got into the oncologist's consciousness.
Is that for a number of different reasons. It was quite delayed in the U.S., for legal reasons, because the original study used different types of chemotherapy drugs, and it had to be completely cleansed of all reference to specific drugs from specific companies. So it was very, very much delayed, and by the time it reached the shores of the U.S., it was already 3 years old, and the question of what about biologics, what about other things had moved on.
But I want to ask Bob, do you think that some kind of a tool that will say, okay, here's the kind of case, here's what 50 researchers or here's what 50 hepatic surgeons would say, would that be helpful in this situation?
I think what's most helpful to oncologists is access to hepatic surgeons who are oncologists, and that it's a team effort. I think there is very little data to help us, and I don't think the Nordlinger study helps me at all. Dan may say it's not yet ready for this, but I would argue it also is not harmful to do this, at least from what I can tell the data. But I think it's more about access to expert oncology surgeons, not just someone who can chop up a liver, someone who understands the biology of colon cancer as it pertains to the liver.
The one thing the OncoSearch algorithm and exercise and interactive program does do is it determines for the non-surgeon resectability versus no resectability, which I think is an important step, regardless of benefit from various therapeutic interventions. Yeah. So from that standpoint, I think it's very useful.
But what about the methodology in determining that, which is to ask researchers what they think, since there's
I think it's a pretty intuitive program that you go through it, it'll tell you resectability versus non-resectability. And I think there isn't a lot of debate relative to that.
But the fundamental basis of that project was investigator perspective and viewpoints. Is that a legitimate thing to try to deliver to oncologists as a way to help make decisions?
Yeah, I think in this instance, for resectability, it certainly is. For the other variables, it becomes more complex. I had one question for Dan relative to the Nordlinger study.
Yes.
I mean, did I understand this correctly that the control group was not controlled for the postoperative therapy that it received?
I don't.
And do we know what postoperative therapy?
No, I've asked Dr. Nordlinger. I asked him 4 months before the presentation, and I was hoping to see some data on that, and I'm not sure they're capturing it.
So in essence, this tells us nothing about the value of perioperative therapy.
Correct.
Vis-a-vis postoperative therapy, since the treated group got both. And the results may be an underestimate, since the control group may have indeed received postoperative adjuvant therapy.
It is hard for me. I'm under the working assumption that many of those patients got postoperative therapy, and it's not being captured by the data. And he acknowledged as much.
I wish you hadn't told me that.
And just to follow up on Norman and Bob's point is that I think at the very least, OncoSearch provided, in a sense, for somebody in, especially a medical oncologist like me who thinks there's a segment 9, is the actual presentation of the cases are very good to, you know, go back
right,
and say,
3D.
If I see this patient, what would Steve Curley, Nord Langer, Graham Poston, John Primrose. These are high-volume people. Is it doable? And then to Bob's point, then you need to reproduce these comments. You've just gotten four consults. You don't necessarily have to go to Houston or London, although it's nice, but you have to find someone who can reproduce that.
Was that in quality. Your algorithm of recommendation that it should be an experienced hepatic oncologic
yes.
surgeon? Howard?
I want to reemphasize for those who are listening that this study was done with patients who were considered resectable by the expert surgeons with up to four liver metastases. And I personally consider this a positive trial, even though other people have gotten up and said it was negative. For me, this is a positive trial for the following reasons. First of all, there were 11 patients in both arms that were ineligible because they had more than four metastases. If you take those out, it falls under the 0.05 cutoff. I think even for this kind of surgical trial, which is extremely difficult to do, and there's clearly attrition at every stage of that, a p-value of 0.058, where we arbitrarily consider 0.05 to be positive, meaning we'll accept 5 times out of 100 that the trial might be falsely positive, and then we increase that to 5.8 for this kind of difficult trial is not difficult for me to accept
small
that difference.
Numbers to start with.
So I think it's a positive trial, and if you take in the fact that some people may have gotten adjuvant therapy postoperatively, that makes it even more likely to be a positive trial, and I think it shows the same level of improvement in three-year disease-free survival that you get for resected primaries, and I think that this should be really considered a major accomplishment by the surgeon.
I'd like to bring this back to the practical, Dan, and ask you, how did you respond to the case that we presented to the faculty? 62-year-old person basically has 3 metastases in the right lobe of the liver, 2 to 3 centimeters prior adjuvant Xelox therapy, no extrahepatic spread, and there's an interesting split in the faculty. 7 say they go right to surgery, 5 would use systemic therapy. How did you vote, Dan? What do you think about these results?
Not surprising, given the differences of opinion about what the Nord-Langer study says or doesn't say. I voted for surgery first, and then consideration, I suppose, of how I feel about adjuvant therapy second. But, you know, Howard, I have to ask 2 questions of you about what you just said. Is, since, you know, I understand the difference of p-values of 0.058 being intriguing, but not necessarily trend setting, if you will, but obviously the ORTC has moved forward with a trial that has no surgery alone control arm, in spite of a trial that is of borderline significance. From the standpoint of, if you were to design a study of adjuvant therapy for liver metastasis in the U.S., would you consider a surgery alone control arm to be unethical based on the results of the Nord-Langer study? And if you're sitting in your office, if I'm sitting in my office in Philadelphia, Sioux City, would you consider a physician who did not offer neoadjuvant therapy to be malpracticing?
I think you're making a distinction between neoadjuvant and chemo plus surgery. I think at this point, surgery alone should not be acceptable. And I think even Nick Petrelli said as much after he spent 10 minutes trashing the concept that there was no data for surgery followed by chemotherapy. In the end, he said, that's what everybody should be doing. So I think that surgery alone is basically unethical at this point. But whether it's done preoperatively or postoperatively is still a valid question.
Is that based on data or wishes?
It's based on biology, data, and wishes.
Norm?
I think Howard, Dan asked you what instrument to use to beat your wife, because I don't think there was a correct answer. Even if we assume that the Nord-Langer study was unequivocally positive, it tells us absolutely nothing about preoperative chemotherapy, whether it's useful, not useful. I mean, that variable was completely untested.
I want to highlight again what Howard said is the trial shows chemo is useful in the context of surgery. It doesn't tell us anything about neoadjuvant, postoperative, whatever.
Precise.
But I do think when we look at the sample size and the effect, we see that right now resected stage 4 disease should have some form of chemotherapy in the context of surgery and planned for right up front. And I think when we talk about p-values, we're talking about an adjuvant setting. We're talking about an adjuvant setting here, and we normally need much larger trials to generate a positive p-value. The p-value, for me, is really meaningless, and I do like the fact that we look at eligible patients if you really want to bring it under 0.05. I mean, you know, the Mosaic trial is positive with a trial which is about 5 times larger. And the effect we see in absolute numbers is about the same that what we see when we compare FOLFOX with 5-FU-leucovorin in stage 3. And we have embraced FOLFOX as standard of care in stage 3 colon cancer, and we have some data on survival benefit now. So for me, clear message is this trial and the great achievement of this trial validates chemotherapy in the context of resected stage 4.
Rich?
So my comment would be that I think we underutilize surgery in patients with liver metastases, and I think we overutilize surgery in patients with liver metastases. And it's not uncommon for me to see somebody who's referred for phase one who I send to the liver surgeon for resection. And then it's also not uncommon for me to send somebody to the liver surgeon, they have their 5 mets removed, and 2 months later when they come in for their first chemo post-op, I do another scan and they got 4 more liver mets. And so I would congratulate the guys from EORTC for having mounted a successful randomized trial in this setting. And I think that Nick Petrelli ought to go to the chair of NSABP, whoever he is, and say, it's time to cast out our hepatic arterial infusion study and let's do a periop versus post-op chemotherapy study that Nick suggested from the podium.
Jordan?
So in ACOSUG, we tried to design the perioperative versus post-op therapy trial. And what we ran across was a lot of statistical problems in terms of patients who progress, how you deal with patients who progress. And we got completely nixed by the NCI saying, no way you should do this at all.
But what do they know?
Well, I've thought that all along. I mean, a federal bureaucracy is not of much use, but
you can quote me on that.
I'm interested in the design of such a pre-op versus post-op study in what the sample size would have to be, because what we're really seeing from the Norlanger study is that the difference between the experimental and control conditions is smaller than we would have hoped and anticipated, and that's why you have a p-value of 0.057.
But he may have already done the trial without adequate control for the post-operative
mm-hmm. Correct.
Adjuvant.
I just think one of the reasons that we should continue to explore this perioperative issue is that it allows us an in vivo chemosensitivity test. And so it would be very difficult to design a large phase 3 trial, but I think you could do a randomized phase 2, which is the chemo is fixed pre and post-op, and the chemo is modified pre-op to post-op depending on response. So in my own head, I have an algorithm that if the frontline therapy does not work, they have stable disease or progression, they usually get a different regimen on the back end without data. But if they've had a nice response to what they received pre-op, I would usually continue that on the back end. Understanding that that's not data-driven, but intuitively, if your therapy is not working preoperatively, why in God's name would you continue it post-op?
And your colleagues down the hall in lung cancer and MD Anderson are doing the battle trials, which is fascinating, lung cancer pre- and post-treatment biopsies to look inside the tumor. Dan?
I just need to perseverate here for a moment on this paradigm shift, is that the study failed to meet its primary endpoint. We admire the ORTC for doing it. We all know what we want the results to be. Should we just stop doing clinical trials and just do things based on what we wanted to have happen? The outcome in this study was roughly that of the PTOC-3 trial, and we're trashing FOLFIRI as an adjuvant therapy for stage 3 colon cancer, even though we wanted it to work and we'd like the option of giving it. So is this a new way of doing trials?
I would say that this was a landmark study because it accomplished getting 350 people
I agree with that, but
liver metastases who went to surgery on a study.
But that's not a reason to take negative results and make them positive.
No, but it's a starting point.
I don't think you can compare this to the PTOC study.
Totally,
you're talking thousands of patients with a p-value versus a few hundred patients with a p-value. I mean, just because the p-values are the same, it's a very different scenario. The PTOC study had tons of power to show a difference that would have been clinically meaningful and failed to do so. This was underpowered to show what would be a clinically meaningful difference in the arms. 7%, I think, is clinically meaningful and a p-value of 0.057.
So I think that the natural conclusion then is we should do small studies, and even if we see a trend and it's not significant, we can then conclude that that's a positive trial if the trend the trend supports our bias.
Yes.
Axel, final comment.
We have to have a bias.
To be honest, I think this addresses one of the problems we're facing right now. We're conducting two large trials to make a small difference, potentially under 0.05 in this p-value, and I think we should conduct smaller trials and look for a biologic effect rather than conducting large trials and use 8,000 patients in breast cancer to get a 1.8% difference in disease-free survival with the use of aromatase inhibitors versus tamoxifen. So I think we are overpowering trials, and when we see a trial that has a clinically meaningful result but just barely scrapes off the significant, statistically significant part, I think it's clinically relevant and it's a great foothold.
By a single digit, this would have been a positive study. No one would have argued about us if they made it a 30% hazard ratio of 0.3. It would have been a magically positive trial by this trend.